Cassette 17, Side 2. But she didn't know that then. Then it was only the end of their canal journey. The burn of the aerial lens had stopped just short of the eastern edge of the Hellas Basin watershed between Dao and Harmakis valleys. The final segment of the canal had been dug by conventional means, and it dropped so precipitously down the steep eastern slope of the basin that frequent locks were necessary, here functioning as dams, so that the canal no longer had the classic look it had had in the highlands, but was rather a series of reservoir lakes connected by short, broad, reddish rivers extending out from under each clear dam. So they boated across lake after lake, down and down in a slow parade of barges and sailboats and cabin cruisers and steamers, and as they dropped in the locks, they could see through their clear walls down the string of lakes like a giant staircase of blue stepping stones, down to the distant bronze plate of the Hellas Sea. Somewhere in the Badlands to right and left, the Dao and Harmakis canyons cut deeply into the Red Rock Plateau, following their more natural courses down the great slope. But with their tents removed, the two canyons weren't visible until you were right on their rims, and nothing could be seen of them from the canal. On board their ship, life went on. Apparently, it was much the same on the Free Mars barge, where Jackie was said to be doing well, still seeing Athos when the two boats were docked in the same town, accepting sympathy graciously, and then turning the topic elsewhere, usually to the campaign business at hand. And their campaign continued to go well. Under Maya's coaching, the Green campaign was being run better than before, but anti-immigrant sentiment was strong. Everywhere they went, the other Free Mars councillors and candidates spoke at the rallies, and Jackie only made occasional short, dignified appearances. She was a lot more powerful and intelligent a speaker than she used to be, but by watching the others speak, Maya got a good sense of who was at the top level of the organization, and several of these people looked very happy to have gained the limelight. One young man, another one of Jackie's young men named Nanetti, stood out in particular, and Jackie didn't seem very pleased to see it. She became cool to him. She turned more and more to Athos and Mika, and even Antar. Some nights she appeared a veritable queen among the consorts, but Maya could see under that to the truth she had witnessed in Antaeus. From 100 meters away she could see the darkness at the heart of things. Nevertheless, when Peter returned her call, Maya asked him to meet her for a talk about the current elections, and when Peter arrived, Maya rested watchfully. Something would happen. Peter looked relaxed, calm. He lived in the Caridad Montes these days, working on the Argyre Wilderness Project, and also with a co-op making Mars-to-space planes for people who wanted to bypass the elevator. Relaxed, calm, even a bit withdrawn. Simon-like. Antar was already angry at Jackie for embarrassing him more than usual by her lack of discretion with Athos. Mika was even angrier than Antar. Now, with Peter on hand, Jackie was baffling and then angering Athos as well as she devoted all her attention to Peter. She was as reliable as a magnet. But she was attracted to Peter, who was as inert to her as always, iron to her magnet. It was depressing how predictable they were, but useful. The Free Mars campaign was subtly losing momentum. Antar was no longer so bold as to suggest to the Kahiran Majaris that they forget about Arabia during its time of troubles. Mika was intensifying the Mars First critique of various Free Mars positions unrelated to immigration and pulling some of the other members of the Executive Council into his sphere. Yes, Peter was acting as intensifier to Jackie's impolitic side, making her erratic and ineffective. So it all was working as Maya had planned. One only had to roll men toward Jackie like bowling balls, and over she would go. And yet Maya felt no sense of triumph. And then they were pushing out of the final lock into Malachite Bay, a funnel-shaped indentation of the Hellas Sea, its shallow water covered by a sun-beaten windchop. Farther out, they pitched gently onto the darker sea where many of the barges and smaller craft turned north and made toward Hell's Gate, the largest deep-water harbor on the east coast of Hellas. Their barge followed this parade, and soon the great bridge crossing Dao Valis appeared over the horizon, then the building-covered walls at the entrance to the canyon, then the masts, the long jetty, the harbor slips. Maya and Michel went ashore and made their way up the cobbled and stared streets to the old Praxis dorms under the bridge. There was an autumn harvest festival the next week that Michel wanted to attend, and then they would be off to Minus One Island and Odessa. After they checked in and dropped their bags, Maya took off for a walk through the streets of Hell's Gate, happy to be out of the canal boat's confinement, able to get off by herself. It was near sunset, near the end of a day that had begun in the Grand Canal. That trip was over. Maya had last visited Hell's Gate back in 2121, during her first peace tour of the basin, working for Deep Waters and traveling with Diana, that was her name, Esther's granddaughter and a niece of Jackie's. That big, cheerful girl had been Maya's introduction to the young natives, really, not only by way of her contacts in the new settlements around the basin, but in herself, in her attitudes and ideas, the way Earth was just a word to her, the way her own generation absorbed all her interest, all her efforts. That had been the first time Maya had begun to feel herself slipping out of the present into the history books. Only the most intense effort had allowed her to continue to engage the moment, to have an influence on those times. But she had made that effort, had been an influence. It had been one of the great periods of her life, perhaps the last great period of her life. The years since then had been like a stream in the southern highlands, wandering through cracks and grabens, and then sinking into some unexpected pothole. But once, 60 years before, she had stood right here, under the great bridge that carried the Peace from cliff to cliff over the mouth of Dao Canyon, the famous Hell's Gate Bridge, with the city falling down the steep sun-washed slopes on both sides of the river facing the sea. At that time there had been only sand out there, except for a band of ice visible on the horizon. The town had been smaller and ruder, the stone steps of the staircase streets rough and dusty. Now they had been polished on their tops by feet toiling up them. The dust had been washed away by the years. Everything was clean and had a dark patina. Now it was a beautiful Mediterranean hillside harbor, perched in the shadow of a bridge that rendered the whole town a miniature, like something in a paperweight or a postcard from Portugal. Quite beautiful in an autumn's early sunset. All shadowed and florid to the west, everything sepia, the moment trapped in amber. But once she had passed through this way with a vibrant young Amazon, when a whole new world was opening up, the native Mars she had helped to bring into being, all of it revealed to her while she was still a part of it. The sun set on these memories. Maya returned to the Praxis building, still located up under the bridge, the final staircase to it as steeply pitched as a ladder. Ascending it with pushes on her thighs to help, Maya suddenly felt an overwhelming sense of déjà vu. She had done this before, not only climbed these steps, but climbed them with the sense that she had climbed them before, with precisely the same feeling that in a yet earlier visit she had been an effective part of the world. Of course. She had been one of the first explorers of Hellas Basin, in the years right after Underhill. That had slipped her mind. She had helped to found Low Point, and then had driven around exploring the basin before anyone else had, even Anne. So that later, when working for Deep Waters and seeing the new native settlements, she had felt similarly removed from the contemporary scene. My God! She exclaimed, appalled. Layer on layer, life after life. They had lived so long. It was like reincarnation in a way, or eternal recurrence. There was some little kernel of hope at the middle of that feeling. Back then, in that first feeling of slipping away, she had started a new life. Yes, she had. She had moved to Odessa and made her mark on the revolution, helping it to succeed by hard work and a lot of thought about why people support change, about how to change without engendering a bitter backlash, which, though perhaps decades removed, yet always seemed to smash back into any revolutionary success, wrecking what was good in it. And it looked as though they had indeed avoided that bitterness. At least until now. Perhaps that was the best way of looking at what was happening in this election, an inevitable backlash of some kind. Perhaps she hadn't succeeded as much as she had thought. Perhaps she had only failed less drastically than Arkady or John or Frank. Who could be sure? So hard to say anymore what was really going on in history. It was too vast, too inchoate. So much was happening everywhere that anything might be happening anywhere. Co-ops, republics, feudal monarchies. No doubt there were oriental satrapies out there in the back country, in some caravan gone wrong, so that any characterization one made of history would have some validity somewhere. This thing she was involved in now, the young native settlements demanding water, going off the Ned and outside Unta's control, no. It wasn't that. Something else. But standing there at the Praxis flat door, she couldn't remember what it was. She and Diana would take a peace train south the next morning, around the southeast bend of Hellas, to see the Zaya Dorsa and the lava tube tunnel they had converted to use as an aqueduct. No. She was here because... she couldn't bring it back. On the tip of the tongue. Deep waters. Diana. They had just finished driving up and down Dal Valles, where on the canyon floor natives and immigrants were starting up an agrarian valley life, creating a complex biosphere under their enormous tent. Some of them spoke Russian. It had brought tears to her eyes to hear it. There. Her mother's voice, sharp and sarcastic as she ironed clothes in their little apartment kitchen nook. Sharp smell of cabbage. No, it wasn't that. Look to the west, to the sea shimmering in the dusk air. Water had flooded the sand dunes of East Hellas. It was a century later, at least. It had to be. She was here for some other reason. Scores of boats, little dots down in a postage stamp harbor behind a breakwater. It wouldn't come back to her. It wouldn't come. A horrible sense of tip-of-the-tongueism made her dizzy, then sick, as if she would get it out by vomiting. She sat down on the step, on the tip of the tongue, her whole life. Her whole life! She groaned aloud, and some kids throwing pebbles at gulls stared at her. Diana! She had met Nergal by accident. They had had a dinner, but Nergal had gotten sick. Sick on Earth! And it all came back with a physical snap, like a blow to her solar plexus, a wave rolling over her. The canal voyage, of course, the dive down into drowned burrows, Jackie, poor Zoe, the crazy fool, of course, of course, of course, she hadn't really forgotten, of course, so obvious now that it was back. It hadn't really been gone. Just a momentary lapse in her thinking, while her attention had wandered elsewhere, to another life. A strong memory had its own integrity, its own dangers, just as much as a weak memory did. It was only the result of thinking that the past was more interesting than the present. Which in many ways was true, but still she found she preferred to sit a while longer. The little nausea persisted. And there was a bit of residual pressure in her head, as if that tongue's hard tipping had left things sore. Yes, it had been a bad moment. Hard to deny when you could still feel the throbbing from that tongue's desperate thrusts. She watched the end of dusk turn the town a deep dark orange, then a glowing color like light shining through a brown bottle. Hell's Gate, indeed. She shivered got up, stepped unsteadily down the stairs into the harborside district where the restaurants ringing the quays were bright moth-flittering globes of tavern light. The bridge loomed overhead like a negative Milky Way. Maya walked behind the docks toward the marina. There was Jackie walking toward her. There were some aides following some way back, but in front it was just Jackie coming toward her unseeing, then seeing. At the sight of Maya, a corner of her mouth tightened, no more, but it was enough to allow Maya to see that Jackie was, what, 90 years old? 100? She was beautiful, she was powerful, but she was no longer young. Events would soon be washing by her the way they did everyone else. History was a wave that moved through time slightly faster than an individual life did, so that even when people had lived only to 70 or 80, they had been behind the wave by the time they died. And how much more so now? No sailboard would keep you up with that wave. Not even a bird suit allowing you to air surf the wave in pelican style, like Zoe. Ah, that was it. It was Zoe's death she saw in Jackie's face. Jackie had tried her best to ignore it, to let it run off her like water off a duck's back, but it hadn't worked, and now she stood in Hell's Gate over star-smeared water, an old woman. Maya, shocked by the intensity of this vision, stopped. Jackie stopped. In the distance, the clack of dishes, the loud burble of restaurant conversations. The two women looked at each other. This wasn't something Maya could remember doing with Jackie, this fundamental act of acknowledgement, meeting the other's eye. Yes, you are real. I am real. Here we are, the both of us, big sheets of glass cracking inside. Something freer, Maya turned and walked away. Michelle found them a passenger schooner going to Odessa by way of -1 Island. The boat's crew told them that Nirga was expected to be on the island for a race, news which made Maya happy. It was always good to see Nirga, and this time she needed his help as well, and she wanted to see -1. The last time she had been there, it hadn't been an island at all, just a weather station and airstrip on a bump in the basin floor. Their ship was a long, low schooner with 5 bird's wing mast sails. Once beyond the end of the jetty, the mast sails extruded their taut triangular expanses, and then, as the wind was from behind, the crew set a big blue kite spinnaker out front. After that, the ship leaped into the clear blue swells, knocking up sheets of spray with every slam into an oncoming wave. After the confinement of the Grand Canal's black banks, it felt wonderful to be out on the sea, with the wind in her face and the waves coursing by. It blew all the confusion of Hell's Gate out of her head. Jackie forgotten, the previous month now understood to be a kind of malignant carnival that she would never have to revisit. She would never return there. The open sea for her, and a life in the wind. Oh, Michelle! This is the life for me. It's beautiful, isn't it? And at the end of the voyage, they were to settle in Odessa, now a seaside town, like Hell's Gate. Living there, they could sail out any day they wanted when the weather was nice, and it would be just like this, windy and sunny. Bright moments in time, the living present, which was the only reality they ever had. The future a vision, the past a nightmare. Or vice versa. Anyway, only here in the moment could one feel the wind and marvel at the waves so big and sloppy. Maya pointed at one blue hillside rolling by in a long, irregular, fluctuating line, and Michelle laughed out loud. They watched more closely, laughed harder. Not in years had Maya felt so strongly the sense of being on a different world. These waves just didn't act right. They flew around and fell over and bulged and wriggled all over their surfaces much more than the admittedly stiff breeze could justify. It looked odd. It was alien. Ah, Mars, Mars, Mars. The seas were always high, the crew told them, on the Hellas Sea. The absence of tides made no difference. What mattered most when it came to waves was gravity and the strength of the wind. Hearing that, as she looked out at the heaving blue plain, Maya's spirits bounced up in the same wild way. Her G was light, and the winds were strong in her. She was a Martian, one of the first Martians, and she had surveyed this basin in the beginning, helped to fill it with water, helped to build the harbors and put free sailors at sea on it. Now she sailed over it herself, and if she never did anything again but sail over it, that would be enough. And so they sailed, and Maya stood in the bow near the bowsprit, hand on the rail to steady her, feeling the wind and the spray. Michel came and stood with her. "So nice to be off the canal," she said. "It's true." They talked about the campaign, and Michel shook his head. "This anti-immigration campaign is so popular."
"Are the Yonsei racist, do you think?"
"That would be hard, given their own racial mix."
"I think they are just generally xenophobic, contemptuous of Earth's problems, afraid of being overrun. So Jackie is articulating a real fear that everyone already has. It doesn't have to be racist."
"But you're a good man." Michel blew out air.
"Well, most people are."
"Come on," Maya said. Sometimes Michel's optimism was too much. "Whether it's racist or not, it still stinks. Earth is down there looking at all our open land, and if we close the door on them now, they're likely to come hammer it open. People think it could never happen, but if the Terrans are desperate enough, then they'll just bring people up and land them, and if we try to stop them, they'll defend themselves here, and presto, we'll have a war. And right here on Mars, not back on Earth or in space, but on Mars. It could happen. You can hear the threat of it in the way people in the UN are trying to warn us. But Jackie isn't listening. She doesn't care. She's fanning xenophobia for her own purposes." Michel was staring at her. Oh, yes. She was supposed to have stopped hating Jackie. It was a hard habit to break. She waved all that she had said away, all the malevolent, hallucinatory politicking of the Grand Canal. "Maybe her motives are good," she said, trying to believe it. "Maybe she only wants what's best for Mars. But she's still wrong, and she still has to be stopped."
"It isn't just her."
"I know, I know. We'll have to think about what we might do. But look, let's not talk about them anymore. Let's see if we can spot the island before the crew."
Two days later, they did just that. And as they approached minus one, Maya was pleased to see that the island wasn't at all in the style of the Grand Canal. Oh, there were whitewashed little fishing villages on the water, but these had a handmade look, an unelectrified look. And above them on the bluffs stood groves of treehouses, little villages in the air. Ferals and fisherfolk occupied the island, the sailors told them. The land was bare on the headlands, green with crops in the sea valleys. Umber sandstone hills broke into the sea, alternating with little bay beaches, all empty except for dune grass flowing in the wind. "It looks so empty," Maya remarked as they sailed around the north point and down the western shore. "They see the vids of this back on Earth. That's why they won't let us shut the door."
"Yes," Michel said. "But look how the people here bunch their population. The Dorsa Brevians brought the pattern up from Crete. Everyone lives in the villages and goes out into the country to work it during the days. What looks empty is being used already to support those little villages." There was no proper harbor. They sailed into a shallow bay overlooked by a tiny whitewashed fishing village and dropped an anchor which remained clearly visible on the sandy bottom 10 meters below. They ferried ashore using the schooner's dinghy, passing some big sloops and several fishing boats anchored closer to the beach. Beyond the village, which was nearly deserted, a twisting arroyo led them up into the hills. When the arroyo ended in a box canyon, a switchback trail gave them access to the plateau above.
On this rugged moor, with the sea in view all around, groves of big oak trees had been planted long ago. Now some of the trees were festooned with walkways and staircases and little wooden rooms high in their branches. These tree houses reminded Maya of Zygote, and she wasn't at all surprised to learn that among the prominent citizens of the island were several of the Zygote ectogenes, Rachel, Tiu, Seemud, Emily. They had all come to roost here and helped to build a way of life that Hiroko presumably would have been proud to see. Indeed, there were some who said that the islanders hid Hiroko and the lost colonists in one of the more remote of these oak groves, giving them an area to roam in without fear of discovery. Looking around, Maya thought it was quite possible. It made as much sense as any other Hiroko rumor, and more than most. But there was no way of knowing, and it didn't matter anyway. If Hiroko was determined to hide, as she must have been if she was alive, then where she hid was not worth worrying about. Why anyone bothered with it was beyond Maya, which was nothing new. Everything to do with Hiroko had always baffled her. The northern end of Minus One Island was less hilly than the rest, and as they came down onto this plain, they spotted most of the island's conventional buildings clustered together. These were devoted to the island's Olympiads, and they had a consciously Greek look to them. Stadium, amphitheater, a sacred grove of towering sequoia, and out on a point over the sea, a small pillared temple made of some white stone that wasn't marble but looked like it, alabaster or diamond-coated salt. Temporary yurt camps had been erected on the hills above. Several thousand people milled about this scene, much of the island's population, apparently, and a good number of visitors from around Hellas Basin. The games were still mostly a Hellas affair, so they were surprised to find Sachs in the stadium, helping to do the measurements for the throwing events. He gave them a hug, nodding in his diffuse way.
"Anarita is throwing the discus today," he said. "It should be good."
And so, on that fine afternoon, Maya and Michelle joined Sachs out on the track and forgot about everything but the day at hand. They stood on the inner field, getting as close to events as they wanted. The pole vault was Maya's favorite. It amazed her. More than any other event, it illustrated to her the possibilities of Martian G. Although it clearly required a lot of technique to take advantage of it, the bounding yet controlled sprint, the precise planting of the extremely long pole as it jounced forward, the leap, the pull, the vault itself, feet pointing at the sky, then the catapulted flight into space, body upside down as the jumper shot above the flexing pole and up, then the neat twist over the bar, or not, and the long fall onto an air gel pad. The Martian record was 14 meters and change, and the young man vaulting now, already winner for the day, was trying for 15, but failing. When he came down off the air gel pad, Maya could see how very tall he was, with powerful shoulders and arms, but otherwise lean to the point of gauntness. The women vaulters waiting their turn looked much the same. It was that way in all the events, everyone big and lean and hard-muscled, the new species, Maya thought, feeling small and weak and old. Homo Martial. Luckily, she had good bones and still carried herself well, or else she would have been ashamed to walk among such creatures. As it was, she stood unconscious of her own defiant grace and watched as the woman discus thrower Sachs had pointed out to them spun in an accelerating burst that flung the discus as if shot from a skeet casting device. This Anarita was very tall, with a long torso and wide rangy shoulders and lats like wings under her arms, neat breasts squashed by a singlet, narrow hips, but a full, strong bottom over powerful, long thighs. Yes, a real beauty among the beauties, and so strong, though it was clear that it was the swiftness of her spin that propelled her discus so far. 180 meters, Michelle exclaimed, smiling. What joy for her! And the woman was pleased. They all applied themselves intensely in the moment of effort, then stood around relaxing or trying to relax, stretching muscles, joking with each other. There were no officials, no scoreboard, only some helpers like Sachs. People took turns running events other than their own. Races started with a loud bang. Times were clocked by hand and called out and logged onto a screen. Shot puts still looked heavy, their throwing awkward. Javelins flew forever. High jumpers were only able to clear 4 meters to Maya and Michelle's surprise. Long jumpers, 20 meters, which was a most amazing sight, the jumpers flailing their limbs through a leap that lasted 4 or 5 seconds and crossed a big part of the field. In the late afternoon, they held the sprints. As with the rest of the events, men and women competed together, all wearing singlets. I wonder if sexual dimorphism itself is lessened in these people, Michel said as he watched a group warm up. Everything is so much less genderized for them. They do the same work, the women only getting pregnant once in their lives or never. They do the same sports, they build up the same muscles. Maya fully believed in the reality of the new species, but at this notion she scoffed. Why do you always watch the women, then? Michel grinned. Oh, I can tell the difference, but I come from the old species. I just wonder if they can. Maya laughed out loud. Come on! I mean, look there and there, pointing. Proportions, faces. Yeah, yeah, but still, it's not like, you know, Bardot and Atlas, if you know what I mean. I do. These people are prettier. Michel nodded. It was as he had said from the start, Maya thought. On Mars, it would finally become clear that they were all little gods and goddesses and should live life in a sacred joyfulness. Gender, however, remained clear at first glance, although she, too, came from the old species. Maybe it was just her. But that runner over there, a woman, but with short, powerful legs, narrow hips, flat chest, and that one next to her. Again, female. No, male. A high jumper, as graceful as a dancer, though all the high jumpers were having trouble. Sachs muttered something about plants. Well, still, even if some of them were a bit androgynous, for most it was the usual matter of instant recognition. You see what I mean? Michel said, observing her silence. Sort of. I wonder if these youngsters really think about it differently, though. If they have ended patriarchy, then there must necessarily be a new social balance of the sexes. That's certainly what the Dorsa Brevians would claim. Then I wonder if that's not the problem with Terran immigration. Not the numbers themselves, but the fact that so many people arriving from Earth are coming from older cultures. It's like they're arriving out of a time machine from the Middle Ages, and suddenly here are all these huge Minoans, women and men much the same. And a new collective unconscious. Yes, I suppose. And so the newcomers can't cope. They cluster in immigrant ghettos or new towns in Tyre, and keep their traditions and their ties to home, and hate everything here. And all the xenophobia and misogyny in those old cultures breaks out again against both their own women and the native girls. She had heard of problems in the cities, in fact, in Sheffield and all over East Tharsis. Sometimes young native women beat the shit out of surprised immigrant assailants. Sometimes the opposite occurred. And the young natives don't like it. They feel like they're letting monsters into their midst. Michel grimaced. Terran cultures were all neurotic at their core, and when the neurotic is confronted with the sane, it usually gets more neurotic than ever, and the sane don't know what to do. So they press to stop immigration and put us at risk of another war. But Michel was distracted by the beginning of another race. The races were fast, but not anywhere near 2.5 times as fast as Terra's, despite the gravity difference. It was the same problem as the high jumpers' plants, but continuous through the race. The runners took off with such acceleration that they had to stay very low to keep from bounding too high away from the track. In the sprints, they stayed canted forward throughout, as if desperately trying to avoid falling on their faces, their legs pumping furiously. In the longer dashes, they finally straightened up near the end and began to scull at the air as if swimming forward from an upright position, their strides longer and longer until they seemed to be leaping forward like one-leg-at-a-time kangaroos. The sight reminded Maya of Peter and Jackie, the two speedsters of Zygote running the beach under the polar dome. On their own, they had developed a similar style. Using these techniques, the winner of the 50-meter dash ran the race in 4.4 seconds, the winner of the 100 in 8.3, the 200 in 17.1, and the 400 in 37.9. But in each case, the balance problems engendered by their speeds seemed to keep them from a full sprint the way Maya remembered seeing it in her youth. In the longer races, the running style was a graceful bounding pace, similar to what they had called the Martian lope back at Underhill, where they had tried it without much success in their tight walkers. Now it was like flight. A young woman led most of the 10,000-meter race, and she had enough in reserve to kick hard at the end, accelerating throughout the entire last lap, faster and faster until she gazelled around the track, only touching down every few meters, lapping some of the other racers, who seemed to toil as she flew past. It was lovely. Maya shouted herself hoarse. She held to Michelle's arm. She felt dizzy. Tears sprang to her eyes, even as she laughed. It was so strange and so marvelous to see these new creatures, and yet none of them knew. None of them. She liked to see women beating men, though they themselves didn't seem to remark it. Women won slightly more often in long distances and hurdles, men in the sprints. Sachs said that testosterone helped with strength, but caused cramping eventually, hampering long-distance efforts. Clearly most of the events were a matter of technique, in any case. And so one saw what one wanted, she thought. Back on Earth, but these people would have laughed if she had started a sentence with that phrase, back on Earth, so what? There had been all sorts of bizarre and ugly behavior back in the nest world, but why worry about that when a hurdle was approaching and another runner advancing in your peripheral vision? Fly, fly! She shouted herself hoarse. At the end of the day, the field athletes finished with their events, cleared a passageway into the stadium and around the track, and a single runner jogged in to sustained applause and wild cheers. And it was Nergal. Starting hoarse already, Maya's shouting was ragged, almost painful. The cross-country racers had started at the southern end of minus one that morning, barefoot and naked. They had run over 100 kilometers over the heavy corrugations of minus one central moors, a devilish network of ravines, grabens, pingo holes, alaces, escarpments, and rockfalls. Nothing too deep, apparently, so that many different routes were possible, making it as much an orienteering event as a run, but difficult all the way. And to come jogging in at 4 p.m. was apparently a phenomenal accomplishment. The next racer wouldn't be coming in until after sunset, people said. So Nergal took a victory lap, looking dusty and exhausted, like a refugee from a disaster. Then he put on pants and ducked his head for his laurel wreath and accepted 100 hugs. Maya was the last of these, and Nergal laughed happily to see her. His skin was white with dried sweat, his lips caked and cracking, hair dust-colored, eyes bloodshot. Ribby and wiry, almost emaciated. He gulped water from a bottle, drained it, refused another. Thanks. I'm not that dehydrated. I hit a reservoir there around Jiri Key. So which way did you take? Someone called. Don't ask, he said with a laugh, as if it had been too ugly to own up to. Later, Maya learned that people's routes were left unobserved and undescribed, a kind of secret. These cross-country races were popular in a certain group, and Nergal was a champion, Maya knew, particularly at the longer distances. People spoke of his routes as if they involved teleportation. This was apparently a short race for him to win, so he was especially pleased. Now he walked over to a bench and sat down. "Let me get myself together a bit," he said, and sat watching the last sprints, looking distracted and happy. Maya sat next to him and stared. She couldn't get enough of him. He had been living on the land for the longest time, part of a feral farmer and gather co-op. It was a life Maya could scarcely imagine, and so she tended to think of Nergal as in limbo, banished to an outback netherworld where he survived like a rat or a plant. But here he was, exhausted but exclaiming at a 400-meter race's photo finish, exactly the vital Nergal she remembered from that Hell's Gate tour so long ago. Glory years for him as well as her. But looking at him, it seemed unlikely that he thought of the past in the same way she did. She felt enthralled to her past, to history. But something other than history was his fulfillment now. His destiny survived and put aside like an old book, and now here he was in the moment, laughing in the sun, having beat a whole pack of wild young animals at their own game, by his wits alone and his feel for Mars, and his Lungompa technique and his hard legs. He had always been a runner. She could see in her mind Jackie and him dashing over the beach after Peter as if it were yesterday. The other two had been faster, but he had gone on all day sometimes, round and round the little lake, for no reason anyone could tell. "Oh, Nergal!" She leaned over and kissed his dusty hair, felt him hugging her. She laughed and looked around at all the beautiful giants around the field, the athletes ruddy in the sunset, and she felt life slipping into her again. Nergal could do that.
This ends Side 2 of Cassette 17 of Blue Mars. Please fast forward to the end before loading Cassette 18.